Welcome to Idiom America, a podcast that explores idioms, those bits of language that are more than the sum of their parts, and that often have an interesting backstory that sheds light not only on how the language evolved, but on culture more generally. Last episode, we looked at pots and pans idioms like out of the frying pan into the fire, flash in the pan, to pan out, pan in, pan over to pan something, dead pan, down the pan, down the toilet, going to pot, and pot shot. Easy shot that you take to kill something to bring it home for the cooking pot. There are more pot idioms to go, though, so let's keep the pot boiling with the next pot idiom. Before we do, though, let's take a look at that one. Keep the pot boiling to make sure that a process doesn't stop, that it remains active or engaging, to maintain momentum. I heard this one used the other day in this way by an announcer of an NBA game, referring to how the team was actively passing the basketball around. But this one is also sometimes used in a way that evokes the image of a seething, boiling pot, and when used this way, it specifically refers to continuing to rouse, incite, antagonize, or provoke someone or something. It's clear that the country's government intends to keep the pot boiling with separatists living in the outer reaches of their border. But the original use of this one dates to the 1700s and referred specifically to providing for sustenance, doing what needs to be done to make a living. And you still sometimes hear this used to mean to manage to earn enough money to buy the essential things in one's life, enough to keep putting food in the pot that's sitting over a constant fire in an old-time kitchen so that it keeps boiling without interruption. A couple of idioms come to mind when speaking of a stew pot, a mishmash, a hodgepodge, or a potpourri, if you will. But first, potpourri is kind of interesting. It comes from an early 17th century French term that denotes a stew made of different kinds of meat, and it meant literally rotten pot or putrid pot, which is kind of funny now that a second meaning of potpourri refers to a mixture of flowers, herbs, spices that's usually kept in a jar and used for a pleasant scent. But as an aside, these stew pots that are never emptied all the way, but which just keep getting replenished with ingredients and liquid as necessary, are often called hunter's pots or hunter stew or perpetual stew or forever soup. Perpetual stew is probably the most common name for these, and they often appear in descriptions of medieval inns. But these perpetual stews can continue cooking for decades or longer if properly maintained. Notable examples include beef and goat noodle soup that's served by Watana Ponich in Bangkok, Thailand, which has been cooking for over 49 years. Or Odin broth from Otofuku in Asakusa, Japan, which has served the same broth daily since 1945. There was a batch of a French dish called pot-au-feu, which was claimed by one writer anyway to be maintained as a perpetual stew in Perpignan from the 15th century until World War II, when they ran out of ingredients to keep the stew going due to the German occupation. At any rate, speaking of these mishmash stews, a couple of idioms come to mind: potluck and melting pot. A potluck or potluck dinner, of course, is a communal gathering where each guest or group contributes a different, often homemade, dish of food to be shared. In my experience growing up, funeral potatoes, baked ham, green beans, jello salads, those were all dishes, homemade rolls, that were sure to appear on the communal table. This use of potluck appears to have originated in the 1920s and 1930s in America, but it comes from an older expression that was used in the UK, to take potluck. And this phrase arose in the 16th century, and it meant food provided for an unexpected or uninvited guest. The luck of the pot, in other words. You show up as a guest at some inn or homestead, and you take your chances at what's being served out of the pot. It's worth mentioning here the term potlatch, which is a Native American gift-giving feast that is practiced by indigenous peoples of the Pacific Northwest that involves giving away or destroying wealth or valuable items in order to demonstrate a leader's wealth and power. Some people have posited a connection between potluck and potlatch, given that they sound similar and they both involve communal feasts, but that doesn't seem to be the case, as the word comes from the Chinook, meaning to give away or a gift. And while we're on it, a random shout out to the town of Potlatch, Idaho, and the Potlatch River that are both named after the Potlatch, which was practiced by some of the tribes in that area. And one final tidbit on potlatches. Canada actually made these illegal in 1884 at the urging of missionaries and government agents who considered it a, quote, worse than useless custom that was seen as wasteful, unproductive, and contrary to, quote, civilized values of accumulation of wealth. This ban wasn't repealed until 1951, and now potlatches are openly held by those indigenous people who are committed to restoring their ancestors' ways. And speaking of the merging of cultures, onto melting pots. The melting pot metaphor arose in the 18th century, sometimes appearing as the smelting pot or the crucible, and it described the fusion of various religious sects, nationalities, and ethnic groups into one distinct people, e pluribus unum. If you've ever taken a tour of the U.S. Capitol building in D.C. the last few years, you've probably seen that movie that's called E Pluribus Unum, Out of Many One. And maybe I'm just sappy, but it still gives me chills every time. Anyway, one of the first precursors of the term was hinted at by the French-American immigrant and author J. Hector St. Jean de Crèvecoeur in 1782, who wrote that in America, individuals of all nations are melted into a new race of men whose labors and posterity will one day cause great changes in the world. A century later, Ralph Waldo Emerson used the melting pot image to describe the, quote, fusing process that transforms the English, the German, the Irish immigrant into an American. The individuality of the immigrant, almost even his traits of race and religion, fuse down in the democratic alembic like chips of brass thrown into the melting pot. And if you're not familiar with an alembic, it's an alchemical still that consists of two vessels connected by a tube that's used for the distillation of liquids. At any rate, the phrase melting pot gained wider currency in the first part of the 1900s during the great waves of Slavic, Jewish, and Italian immigration, thanks in large part to a play by Israel Zangwill called The Melting Pot. And in it, a character says with enthusiasm, "America is God's crucible, the great melting pot where all the races of Europe are melting and reforming." And I think it's fair to say that this play is probably the most responsible for the modern-day popularity of the term. And nowadays, the melting pot process has come to take on the meaning of immigrants to the United States that are being Americanized. And that is, they're being culturally assimilated and acculturated into the country. You might think that stirring the pot would accelerate the melting process, but you got to wonder sometimes if that's indeed the case. Stirring the pot, of course, means to bring up hot topics and controversial discussions that are sure to make some people uncomfortable and on edge. Politics, religion, gossipy drama, that kind of thing. Some might say that stirring the pot causes needless conflict. Others, that it provokes a healthy discussion that's at the core of a democracy. And as far as making for a good melting pot, I think I'd probably come down on the side of stirring the pot. Picture a pot of soup. A lot of ingredients have settled to the bottom, out of sight. When you stir the pot, you bring things to the surface, make them visible. And that raising of awareness alone can sometimes be enough to affect positive change. And sure, this includes some things that some would prefer to keep buried, undisturbed. And sure, stirring makes everything bump into each other more, and that can mean conflict. And you can take it all too far too fast, but stirring the pot also helps release flavors. Instead of just having them sit there in their own isolated lump at the bottom of the pot, they're contributing their own unique flavor to the stew. And all that makes for a better national stew, in my opinion. One more pot one that touches on those themes of immigration, pursuit of a better life, out of many one, is a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and that's kind of a fun rabbit hole to go down to read about the origins of this one, leprechauns and rainbow cups and Vikings, etc. If you can wade through all the sites that are trying to get you to invest in gold. But let's take a look at a different pot of gold, the jackpot, meaning a money prize pool that accumulates until somebody wins it, like the lottery, or it can mean just a large cash prize or money in general, or even more broadly, any kind of unexpected windfall or reward. Coming across a bowl of candy with nerds in them when you're out trick-or-treating on Halloween. Oh yeah, jackpot. Where'd this one come from? It originally popped up around the 1870s, and it was from the poker game Jacks Are Better, which is like traditional five-card draw, except in this case, if you as a player don't have a pair of Jacks Are Better in the first round of betting, you have to pass, which, to get technical, and if you're not into poker, your ears might start to glaze over here a bit, but Jacks Are Better doesn't necessarily mean you have to be holding a pair of Jacks, Queens, Kings, or the like. You just have to be holding cards that will beat a pair of Tens. But if nobody holds Jacks Are Better, the hand must be redealt with an additional ante required so the pot can grow just from these antes. And the pot can also grow in a second way. When the game is over, no player is allowed to win with anything less than three of a kind or better. And so if at the end no one has better than three of a kind or more, then no player gets the pot and the hand is redealt with an additional ante required to be added to the existing accumulating pot. And over time, this pot can potentially grow quite large, hence jackpot from Jacks Are Better, variation of poker. And within a few decades, this term made its way from the poker tables into culture writ large. And with the advent of slot machines and then lotteries, the term's gotten really popular. And there are a lot of idioms from card games, poker in particular, and that's something that'd be fun to look into in a future episode. One thing I didn't know about pots before this episode was that back in the Middle Ages, pot was used to mean skull or head. You can find examples of this from as far back as 1425. So this leads to a few idioms, most common one probably being, at least here in America, crackpot, meaning a colorfully strange or eccentric person. Or if used more derogatorily, as it usually is, someone who has extreme or unusual beliefs, wildly foolish notions. People who take up unpopular causes or conspiracy theories are often called crackpots. And some synonyms here would be crank, fruitcake, nut, nutcase, nutter, oddball, screwball, kook. Break it down and you have crack and pot or head, so literally a cracked head. That kind of speaks for itself in terms of origin and meaning. One thing to add is that this one used to be more often used as the even more literal brain cracked or cracked brained. But you don't hear this one as much anymore. There are other instances of calling people some kind of pot. The Brits have toss pot, which means a stupid or obnoxious person, or a habitual drinker of alcohol who's frequently intoxicated, a drunkard. They also have fuss pots, a person who is often not satisfied and complains about things that aren't important. A synonym for that one is fuss budget. And there are honeypots, often used in spycraft, meaning, of course, a person or thing that acts as a lure or a decoy in a trap, scam, or scheme. There are also sexpots, often used in spycraft, which just refer to sexually attractive people, particularly conspicuously sexy women. All right, let's look at that idiom we left off with last episode. Pot calling the kettle black. The Dictionary of Clichés has this to say about that one. An assertion that someone else has the very faults that can be attributed to you. The presumption being that the accuser is unaware of having such faults. The saying dates from centuries ago when stoves ran on wood or coal. Presumably, after long use, both the pot and the kettle would be black. We can also surmise, however, that in many households, the kettle, particularly if made of copper, was kept polished and hence reflected the blackness of the pot. The pot, looking at the reflection, would see black, which would appear to be on the side of the kettle. The pot could then accuse the kettle of a fault it did not have. Don Quixote, written in the early 17th century, contains a sentence that can be translated, "You are like what is said that the frying pan said to the kettle, Avaunt, black brows." A Dictionary of Cant, published in 1699, recorded the saying in its present form and offered the definition, when one accuses another of what is as deep in himself. Deep being capitalized there for some reason. Well, thank you, Dictionary of Clichés, for that concise yet informative explanation. This dictionary is a book from 1985 by James Rogers that a friend gave me, and it comes in handy for this podcast. But I got to say, I think it could have used a different title. Really should have marketed itself as something like the Idiom Dictionary, because nobody wants to use clichés, but idioms? That's a different kettle of fish. And it's not true that the Dictionary of Clichés only has clichés. I just open it to a random page and I see these entries. Far from the madding crowd, the fat is in the fire, without fear or favor. You can't fairly say that any of these phrases are overused or betray a lack of original thought like clichés are supposed to do. Good book, bad title, James Rogers. Bad title. But while we're on kettles, let's take a look at that one. Different kettle of fish, which means basically a whole other ball of wax, or a different thing altogether. It's used to describe something or someone in an entirely different sense right after talking about the same subject. This is one thing, something similar is something different altogether, that kind of thing. Donald Trump's trial for XYZ is one thing, but his trial for ZYX is a different kettle of fish. The origins of this one are a bit murky, but it appears to date from the late 1800s, maybe to Scotland. And it does seem clear that this one ultimately comes from the other idiom, pretty kettle of fish, meaning a disagreeable or annoying situation, a real mess, which goes back to at least the early 1700s. And this kettle here isn't your dainty tea kettle for boiling water. In former centuries, a kettle was a big metal pot that was used for boiling liquids or cooking, and a fish kettle was a common household implement, big pot to cook fish in. And the phrase a kettle of fish was also used in northern England and Scotland to describe an outdoor salmon picnic, as well as the pot in which it was prepared. And these kettles of fish sound like a pretty good time. From a 1785 description, it is customary for the gentlemen who live near the Tweed to entertain their neighbors and friends with the fete champêtre, a picnic which they call giving a kettle of fish. Tents or marquees are pitched near the flowery banks of the river, a fire is kindled, and live salmon are thrown into boiling kettles. All right, we've pretty much come full circle now from part one of these episodes about pots and pans idioms and the bright copper kettles from The Sound of Music. Let's look at one last idiom about tea kettles and pots, the teapot and tempests in teapots, which is an idiom that refers, of course, to small events that have been exaggerated out of proportion, an overreaction that's out of proportion to a minor event, a lot of unnecessary anger and worry about a matter that's not all that important. And the idea here being that you can't have too big of a storm, the waves can't be too big in the small little pond of a teapot. And there are variants in other languages that convey that same images of how storms can't get too wild on a small body of water. In languages like Arabic and Bengali, you get storms in cups. In French and Dutch, you get tempests in glasses of water. In Yiddish, there are squalls in spoons of water. In Greek, there are drownings in a spoon of water. And some favor teacups, like Tom Hill and Korean, which both find typhoons in teacups. And Chinese, that apparently covers both bases with winds and waves in teacups and storms in teapots. In Britain, storm in a teacup rules, while in the U.S., it's tempest in teapots. There are also some other variations in English over the centuries, such as a storm in a cream bowl from 1678 and a storm in a wash basin from 1830. Is one right and the other wrong, and which came first? Well, if you look on the internet, there are a lot of strong opinions out there on this one. But the very exercise of arguing about the exact origin of this one seems ultimately kind of unimportant to me, a reflection of the ultimate futility of etymology once you go too far back. And the whole heated debate seems itself kind of like a tempest in a teapot. So I'll leave it there, and I'll leave this episode there too. Thanks for listening.